Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 22nd of April, these are our main stories. The head of Israeli military intelligence has resigned, the first senior Israeli figure to step down over the Hamas attacks on October the 7th. The president of Ecuador has won a referendum for tougher security measures to combat violent drugs gangs. Filipino and US troops begin joint military exercises at a time of tensions between the Philippines and China. Also in this podcast...
And they never found the body because there used to be a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
We hear how President Biden's latest gaffe has offended people in Papua New Guinea. As we record this podcast, a court in New York is due to start hearing opening arguments in the unprecedented criminal trial of Donald Trump. A jury will hear initial evidence from prosecutors and defense lawyers, and we'll bring you the outcome of that first day of the trial in our next edition of the Global News Podcast. But for this edition, we start in Israel, where the head of military intelligence has resigned over his role in failing to stop the Hamas attacks on October the 7th. Major General Aharon Haliva is the highest-ranking Israeli official to step down over the attacks in which well over 1,000 people were killed. Israel's opposition leader, Yair Lapid, said his resignation was justified and the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, should follow suit. In Gaza itself, the Hamas authorities say they've now retrieved around 200 bodies from a mass grave at a hospital where there was heavy fighting with Israeli forces. I spoke to our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, in Jerusalem. I started off by asking her about the intelligence chief's resignation.
This is a high-profile resignation, the first general of the army's general staff to leave his position due to the failures that led to the 7th of October attack. And in the week after Hamas gunmen broke into southern Israel, we did have Major General Aharon Haliva publicly taking responsibility as the head of Israeli military intelligence. And he has now, 6 months on, written in his resignation letter that the intelligence division did not live up to the task we were entrusted with. And notably, he also called for the establishment of a state investigative committee, which he said should look in depth and look at all the different factors and circumstances that led to those difficult events.
Could there be more resignations to follow?
I mean, certainly it's anticipated that there will be resignations, perhaps not always so high profile. But really, the stance has been that, you know, Israel went very quickly into its response to those attacks, the war in Gaza that has raged for the past 6 months. And so really many were expecting after the war was over to have more of a focus on military, potentially also political resignations, with different fingers being pointed, particularly by anti-government protesters, at those they think should be held to account for those awful events of 6 months ago and for, you know, different failures that allowed them to take place.
And meanwhile, in Gaza, there's this mass grave that's been discovered in the courtyard of Al Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in central Gaza. What more can you tell us about that?
So Israel's military pulled its forces out of Khan Yunis, the biggest city in the south of the Gaza Strip, which has been so much the focus of its offensive there earlier this month. And since then, we've had locals, we've had rescue staff going back, trying to find out what happened to some 2,000 people still missing, most of them presumed to be dead under the rubble. And a lot of focus has been on the Nasser Hospital, where the Israeli military said it carried out a precise and limited operation there against Hamas gunmen, it said, were using the site. And we had a large evacuation at the time of some of the displaced people and medics and patients that were there. But now these reports of about another 50 bodies found a day ago in a mass grave, bringing close to 200 bodies in the last few days, the number that has been found there. And local people trying to identify those. The Israeli military asked about this and said it's checking the reports.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. It's a resounding victory for Ecuador's president in his battle against the drugs gangs that have terrorized his country. Voters have backed Daniel Noboa's plans to strengthen security, which include allowing the military to patrol streets, harsher jail terms, and the extradition of wanted criminals. Even as voting was taking place, the authorities reported the death of a prison director. The violence in Ecuador made international headlines in January when gunmen stormed a live television broadcast at the same time as dozens of prison guards were being taken hostage. With more from the capital, Quito, here's our South America correspondent, Ione Wells.
The centre of Quito is full of lively, jovial scenes. But people here tell me they're now constantly looking over their shoulders in fear. Homicides, kidnappings and robberies have soared in Ecuador as the influence of violent criminal gangs has erupted.
We're just heading into a youth centre now in a suburb of Quito. There's a boxing ring with some guys boxing, lots of people spectating from the sidelines. We're here to meet Carmen, who works here. Her brother, Darwin, was killed 2 years ago when he was 19 years old by a gang member who just wanted money.
The gang threatened us at our house, throwing stones at us because the murder occurred next to my son. They said, if the gang member goes to the prison, my son would be the next person to die. I think militarizing the country is not the solution. Instead of investing that, they should invest in the youth.
A cocaine dealer I spoke to, known as El Gato, the cat, illustrates her point. He didn't want to be identified, so we've changed his voice.
I started selling and smoking when I was 14 years old. We went through financial problems. My mother was always working and never there for me. I was alone in the house, crying and screaming for my mom. Then I met my friends, bad friends, who introduced me to drugs. I believe that the country's economic crisis is what led to so much crime.
Surprisingly, he was in favor of tighter security measures, saying he'd like to leave this life if only beating addiction felt possible. This vote came after a state of emergency was called in January, when armed gunmen stormed a TV station, a gang leader escaped from prison, and there was a wave of prison riots and politicians murdered. The military were brought in to control the situation. The president hopes this vote gives him a mandate for this to continue.
We need security. Get rid of narco trafficking and criminality to bring peace to this country.
In my opinion, it's unnecessary. They say we have no money, but they are spending money badly with this vote.
While some hope tighter security will give them the right to live their lives free of fear, others fear it could lead to abuses of their rights. Carlos Mendez was leaving work one day when police carrying out a raid nearby beat him up arbitrarily. His father said they still live in fear.
It is a trauma that we have been experiencing up until now. We have fear that this could happen again. Our concern now is there could be more soldiers, more controls, and that is where the abuses arise.
There's one thing everyone here agrees on. They all want Ecuador to return to the relatively peaceful, touristy country it once was. The test for the government is if these measures can achieve that.
That report by Ione Wells. The British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, says the first flights carrying asylum seekers to Rwanda will leave in 10 to 12 weeks, despite strong disagreements in Parliament, which have held up a bill the government regards as a flagship policy in its efforts to reduce illegal immigration. Mr. Sunak said an airfield was on standby and commercial charter planes booked. The bill to process migrants in Rwanda, some of whom have risked their lives in small boats to enter the UK, has been repeatedly opposed by the upper house, the House of Lords. But Mr. Sunak said that both houses of Parliament will have to keep sitting and voting until the bill is passed.
For almost 2 years, our opponents have used every trick in the book to block flights and keep the boats coming. But enough is enough. No more prevarication, no more delay. Parliament would sit there tonight and vote no matter how late it goes. No ifs, no buts, these flights are going to Rwanda. We are going to deliver this indispensable deterrent so that we finally break the business model of the criminal gangs and save lives.
Barbara Plet-Usher is in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. I asked her why the bill is so controversial.
Well, it's controversial because, first of all, there is the whole principle of deporting asylum seekers to another country and saying that Britain doesn't want them and doesn't want to process them. So there's that larger picture. But the more sort of significant thing is that the Supreme Court had objected to this deal because it said Rwanda was not a safe country for refugees and asylum seekers. And so the UK government and Rwanda, they signed a treaty dealing with some of the concerns that the court had. Principally, it was the possibility or the risk that Rwanda might deport some of these people back to their countries of origin. And that has been mentioned in the treaty. And now both Rwanda and the UK are trying to put that into law. And this law in the UK is basically saying this means that Rwanda is safe. It also means that it'll make it harder for asylum seekers to appeal against being moved there.
And the cost of this has mounted. I think it goes into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet, I don't think that many migrants are expected, possibly a few hundred?
Well, initially when the deal was made, the idea was to send many, many of the migrants here. At this point, it seems what the government is hoping to do is at least get one plane load of refugees or asylum seekers to Rwanda to underline the point that the bill has been passed and that this is their policy. But of course, there's an election coming up in the UK, and the Labour Party has said if it wins, it's not going to support this policy. So in the end, it might only be a few hundred. But the bigger picture is that there are countries in Europe that are watching this process. And if the if Britain finds a legal way to get around objections by the European Commission for Human Rights, then it may well serve as a precedent for other countries to try similar policies.
And what do people in Rwanda make of all this?
Well, it's not getting the attention here that it gets in the UK. So a couple of people that we spoke to said this would be good for the economy. It would mean there'd be more consumers. One man that we spoke to felt the opposite, that there were already not enough jobs and land in this very tiny, densely populated country to go around for Rwandans. And so just sending more people here would add to the competition. And that is the view of the opposition party here in Rwanda as well, that this is that the government should be focused on getting more jobs and benefits for the people of Rwanda, not accepting migrants.
Barbara Plet-Usher in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. More than 16,000 American and Filipino troops have begun a joint military exercise in the Philippines, which they're describing as their most expansive yet. The exercise, which also involves the French Navy, takes place at a time of heightened tensions between the Philippines and China over disputed islands in the South China Sea. Beijing has warned Manila against bringing in external forces, which it says could threaten regional stability. Zhang Zhuxia is vice chair of China's Central Military Commission.
As our president has pointed out, the Pacific Ocean is large enough to accommodate all countries of the Pacific. The Chinese people advocate peace and have no intention of engaging in a cold or hot war with any country. But territorial sovereignty is inviolable. We will legitimately defend our rights and will resolutely counteract unreasonable provocation.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head, has more details about these large-scale drills.
They're annual exercises, but not on this scale. And they're involving things like the Typhoon missile launch system. It's a medium-range missile launch system that could launch missiles from the northern Philippines that could actually reach the southern Chinese coast and, of course, go over Taiwan. So, you know, the symbolic potency of these exercises at a time like this is not being missed by anyone. China's also pointed out they claim that they had a gentleman's agreement with the Philippines from the previous administration of President Rodrigo Duterte, who was much more pro-Chinese and much more anti-American, not to challenge the status quo. And, of course, the status quo in the South China Sea is that China has occupied a number of islands and built, you know, quite sophisticated facilities. These are islands claimed by the Philippines and other countries. And President Marcos has reversed that conciliatory approach. Obviously, the islands, the Philippines claims, matter a lot to it. There's a lot of Filipino public opinion behind standing up to China over these. There's a rusted Filipino landing ship that's been set for a long time, rotting away on one of the reefs that the Philippines tries to resupply. Every time it does, it gets confronted by Chinese naval ships and Coast Guard ships that attack them with water cannon and ramming them. That's been going on for a while, and that's where one set of exercises will take place. So that's very much a show of support by the US and other partners for the Philippines in that area. And so against that backdrop, seeing the Philippines bring on these very sophisticated joint exercises with the US and other countries, and inevitably is seen by China as a show of force directed to very much at Beijing. The bigger question is, how far is the Philippines going to push this? And this is a big change of stance by the Philippines. It's now the most assertive country in Southeast Asia and standing up to China, yet its own military is quite weak. No one knows quite how far they're willing to go in confronting China over these disputed areas.
Jonathan Head. Three people, including a married couple, have been arrested in Germany on suspicion of spying for China. They'll appear before judges in the coming days, as Jessica Parker reports from Berlin.
The arrests took place in western Germany this morning, in the city of Düsseldorf and the town of Bad Homburg. Searches, say the authorities, were carried out at the homes and workplaces of the three accused. Under German privacy conventions, they've been named only as Thomas R. and married couple Herwig F. and Ina F. The prosecutor says they are strongly suspected of having worked for Chinese intelligence by providing information on new technologies that can be used for military purposes. It's even alleged a special laser was sent to China without authorization. It comes after last week two men were arrested in the southern state of Bavaria on suspicion of spying for Russia.
Jessica Parker in Berlin. The world's countries are spending more money than ever on defence. Figures published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute show that last year nearly $2.5 trillion was allocated to military expenditure. The report said there was no region in the world where the security situation had improved in 2023. Suranjana Tiwari, our business correspondent, has been looking at the figures. She spoke to Rob Young.
It is because of those wars and rising tension fueling spending across the world. Now, this is a report from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, and researchers say that military spending rose across the globe with particularly large increases in Europe, the Middle East and Asia. Researchers saw spending increase across all five geographical regions, with the US, China, Russia, India and Saudi Arabia being the top five spenders.
Any surprises in the list?
Well, there were a lot of countries that were not a surprise. Ukraine, Russia, Israel, as you can imagine, because of the conflicts there. China has always been a big spender and continues to increase its spending. Japan, slightly interesting, but obviously there's a lot of tensions in the region, and therefore Japan feels the need to bolster its defenses. Taiwan also has increased its spending by about 11%. Other surprises are the Dominican Republic, fearing gang violence in neighbouring Haiti, and the Democratic Republic of Congo also worried about tensions growing with neighbouring Rwanda. And South Sudan saw an increase of 78%, which was the second largest increase out of all the countries polled.
Suranjana Tiwari. Still to come in this podcast.
Lisa, can you do that? Well, as I'm saying yes, I'm thinking to myself, that's a girl's hairstyle. And how am I going to actually do it?
We hear how David Bowie came up with his iconic red spiky hairstyle for Ziggy Stardust.
I knew right at that moment that my whole life was gone. I'm going to jail for a very, very long time. There was no doubt about it.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast with astonishing personal stories from across the globe.
And honestly, even at that point of reporting to a journalist, I don't think I really knew that that was in itself an act of whistleblowing.
Expect the unexpected.
The only future is death here. So if we live, we might have a chance. We will die anyway, but we will die trying.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. It's not just Israel that Iran has attacked in recent weeks and months. In January, it fired missiles on a border region of Pakistan, which provoked a retaliatory strike. Now, as the two Muslim neighbours seek to mend their relations after those unprecedented tit-for-tat military attacks, the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi is visiting Pakistan. The red carpet was rolled out and there was a guard of honour. Our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davis told us more about the significance of the Iranian leader's visit.
Well, I'm currently sitting opposite one of the main roundabouts here in Islamabad, which is covered in both Iranian and Pakistan flags and lots of symbols saying Pakistan, Iran, together in progress, long live Pakistan, Iran, friendship. So this is really very much a show from both sides. They want to signal that this is a good relationship between the two. Of course, this comes against the backdrop of back in January, as you mentioned, that Iran launched missiles that hit inside Pakistan territory, saying it was targeting a militant group. Pakistan then responded in kind and hit inside Iranian territory, saying they were hitting a militant group. And since then, they seem to have come to some form of kind of brotherly relations between the two. But that does mean that this is a very important visit by the Iranian president here. They have particularly emphasized that this is about trade and trying to increase the amount of trade between the two countries. But there is going to be a discussion as well, they understand, about energy and security.
Yes, because Pakistan has historically been very close to Saudi Arabia, but it very much wants to get its hands on some of that Iranian gas.
Yes, and that is the crucially important part here. And this has been a sort of a slightly fraught dynamic as well to try to make that final deal. It's been a long time in the pipeline. And so that is something that's expected to be discussed. And maybe you might get an announcement later about that. But interestingly, earlier on last week, the roundabout was decorated very differently. Then they had a Saudi delegation in town. And instead of the Iranian flag, we had the Saudi Arabian flag as well. So Pakistan really trying to reach out to all of its potential allies in the area, all of the countries nearby that it thinks it can make deals with. Pakistan is in a difficult economic position still. We know that they are negotiating a deal with the IMF at the moment, the International Monetary Fund, to make sure that it will be able to continue to make its sort of balance of payments. But we also know that they are in a dangerous and difficult position with energy as well. They need to make sure that their energy supplies are strong enough. And a particularly key point is to make sure that they are good enough, strong enough for the summer, when all of the country is so reliant on being able to have air conditioning and fans operating to be able to continue to operate functionally.
Caroline Davis in Pakistan. Many people have expressed concern about President Biden's memory lapses and gaffes as he runs for a second term at the White House against Donald Trump. Now Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister has added his voice to the growing chorus. James Merape made it clear he was unhappy that Mr. Biden had implied that his long-lost uncle may have been eaten by cannibals after being shot down over Papua New Guinea during the Second World War. Mickey Bristow reports.
A plane carrying President Biden's uncle Ambrose Finnegan ditched into the sea off the northern coast of Papua New Guinea in 1944. Uncle Bose's body was never found. But last week, while speaking at a war memorial in Pennsylvania, President Biden speculated about what might have happened to him.
My Uncle Bose flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. He got shot down in New Guinea, and they never found the body because there used to be a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
The Papuan Prime Minister James Merape has dismissed Mr. Biden's gaffe, putting it down to a blurry moment. But the Prime Minister also made two serious points. While Papua New Guinea does have some history of cannibalism, there's no evidence that Mr. Biden's uncle met this fate. And Mr. Merape said his country didn't deserve to continually be the butt of this punchline. He also used the opportunity to urge the US to clear the unexploded bombs that still litter the nation. He said the Second World War had been nothing to do with his people, but they'd been dragged into it anyway.
Mickey Bristow. At the height of the Lebanese civil war in the 1980s, dozens of foreigners, mostly Westerners, were kidnapped by Islamist extremists. Of those that survived, the hostage who was held the longest was the American journalist Terry Anderson. He endured nearly 7 years of appalling conditions before finally being released to a hero's welcome in the US. He has now died at the age of 76. Despite being beaten, chained to a wall, and repeatedly threatened with death by his captors, Mr. Anderson never stopped challenging them. Alfie Habershon looks back at his life.
Terry Anderson was a journalist who became part of the story he covered. He grew up in Ohio before fighting for the Marines in the Vietnam War as a staff sergeant. His reporting for the Associated Press then took him across the globe, to Kentucky, Japan, and South Africa, before he arrived in Lebanon as chief of the Middle East Bureau. Based in Beirut, he had spent several years reporting on the rising violence that was gripping a war-torn Lebanon. Until one day, in 1985, when returning home with a friend from a tennis match, he was bundled into the back of a green Mercedes by gunmen. And he did not return home again for nearly 7 years, spending the majority of that time chained and blindfolded in solitary confinement. At the time, he was one of more than a dozen Westerners held hostage in Lebanon by Islamist groups, and he was also the last to be let go. When he was released, it was a moment of celebration in America, with his face plastered across Time magazine, captioned "The Smile of Freedom." As he addressed the world in a press conference, he seemed energized and upbeat.
Yesterday afternoon, my captors came in, brought some new clothes, new shoes, my first in 7 years, and they hurt my feet, by the way. And they said that I would be going home today. I spent the day pacing the room and playing solitaire and waiting. I think this last 24 hours had been longer than the whole 6.5 years.
But he later admitted that the experience had left him deeply scarred and almost caused him to go insane, crediting his Roman Catholic faith and stubborn personality for helping him survive. In his final years, he taught at several prominent universities, but also lent into new interests, operating a blues bar, a Cajun restaurant, and a horse ranch. His daughter, Salome Anderson, also a journalist, described her dad as a hero, who was content with the life he had led.
Alfie Habershon, looking back on the life of Terry Anderson, who has died at the age of 76. A newly discovered masterpiece by the Italian Renaissance painter Raphael has gone on public display in the south of France after being sold for a fraction of its true value. The small portrait of Mary Magdalene was bought from a London gallery. Neither the seller nor the buyer had known the identity of the artist, Terry Egan reports.
The Santa Marie Madeleine Basilica houses what are said to be the remains of Mary Magdalene, making it Christianity's third most important tomb. Now, for a month, it's also housing a portrait which, since September, is known to have been painted by the great Raphael. It was bought by an unnamed collector from a London gallery's website for nearly $40,000 before he called in art experts in Italy. Numerous analyses followed, including by infrared light, which revealed layers of carbon under the paint. And then, not without controversy, the picture of Mary was sensationally attributed to the Renaissance master. Now it's being displayed in a place that couldn't be more fitting. Mary Magdalene is a crucial figure in the story of Jesus. She is said to have been a repentant sinner, but was perhaps the first to witness his resurrection. And recent stories have implied an even more intimate relationship between them. Either way, many believe she spent the last years of her life in France, in a cave near the Basilica, which makes it an important site for pilgrims. And so people have been duly queuing up there to see the unassuming masterpiece, and handing over €3 for the privilege. A small price to pay, perhaps, for a glimpse of this startling take by a 16th century genius on someone so closely associated with Jesus.
Terry Egan reporting. When it comes to iconic rock hairstyles, there's Elvis's quiff, the Beatles' mop tops, and the long flowing locks of many rock stars. But one rock haircut not only stands out, but stands up. That's David Bowie's red spiky Ziggy Stardust haircut, one that helped inspire generations of glam and punk rockers. With a new album of remixed and unheard-of Bowie tracks out this month from his Ziggy Stardust days, the BBC caught up with one of those closest to him from that time, his hairstylist and friend Susie Ronson, the woman who crafted that iconic Ziggy cut and colour. She said it all began with a visit to Bowie's home to perm his wife Angie's hair.
Well, she changed her mind about the perm, but David was there. And David and her were talking about, you know, cutting his hair short. He had kind of longish blonde hair at the time. So he asked me my opinion, and I said, well, no one's got short hair. And it was true, nobody did. You know, when you think about who else was out there, Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, they all had long hair. I said, it might look really good. So that's when he got up and he showed me this photograph in a magazine of a girl model with his short red spiky hair. And he said, can you do that? Well, as I'm saying yes, I'm thinking to myself, that's a girl's hairstyle. And how am I going to actually do it? But when I looked at him, I mean, I thought, my God, if anyone could pull this one off, he could. Tall, rock star thin, lovely long white neck, great face. I mean, it would look really good on him if I could do it. Well, I did it, and of course it didn't stand up. I was cautiously optimistic. But when I finished, it wouldn't stand up. It just kind of flopped. He looked like a schoolboy. So I went away, I found the colour. We had a junior at the salon. She had the same colour hair as David, kind of a blondie mousy brown thing. So I took a snip of her hair and experimented. And I found the colour, Red Hot Red by Schwarzkopf. I used a high volume peroxide to give it some lift. Voila, that was the colour. Then I thought about using the guard to make it stand up, and it worked. Huge wave of relief washed over me. We didn't have any setting lotions like that in those days. This particular treatment made hair sets like stone, and I used that. I poured a liberal amount of it, whooshed it all through his hair, and dried it and pulled it away from his head and pulled it away from his head, and it stood up.
Susie Ronson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Vladimir Muzechka. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in these environments.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.